The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slipper Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Hi everyone, I'm Jeanette Garcia and I'm the host for Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Louis Ress. And today we're going to be going over episode 15, L-1011. And Louis, can you give us a little briefing on what we're going to discuss today?
It's going to be a fascinating discussion about air crashes in the Everglades. But before I get into that, I want to tell you that my new book is out.
Oh, Miami Memoirs.
Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring. And The Maharani's Ring is a great story. It's about my mother.
Oh.
And so you'll enjoy that book. Mm-hmm. And it's getting rave reviews. In fact, the reviewer called me up and said, "This is the best thing you've ever did. This is the most wonderful book. I love every page of it. I couldn't put it down. They should make it into a movie."
Oh,
and I said, "Thank you." Good. And she said, "Is that all you have to say?" And I said, "Thank you, sis." So my sister really enjoyed the book.
Oh, that's great.
You like that one?
Where can everyone buy it?
Oh, it's on Amazon now. Okay. And it's very reasonable. And all of my royalties go to charity. Those charities include a scholarship at the FIU for first to go to college in the family.
Oh, great. First generation.
First generation, right. We have a wonderful scholarship there. So that's where the money's going.
That's great.
Let me just tell you about the L-1011 crash.
Mm-hmm.
This was the latest plane, and I'll tell you about it. The sky was black. The ground was black. There were no lights. There were no beacons. There was no way to tell up from down. It was that black. Eastern Airlines Lockheed 1011, the newest, most sophisticated, most advanced airliner of the time, was flying out over the Everglades, those black swamps. And it was heading for Miami International Airport. It was coming in from New York City. And everything was dark, black, dead, lifeless. There was no horizon. The crew was preparing for landing. They were about 70 miles out to the west of Miami. And they were protected by radar, electronic sensors, altimeters, every conceivable scientific device to ensure the safety of the plane. The front lock wheel didn't go on. There's a light. The light didn't go on. The wheels were supposed to be down, but they didn't know, or were they down? The pilot, Bob Loft, put the plane on autopilot, and they would check to see if the wheels were down. Maybe the bulb was out. You know, it could be a lot of things. Evidently, one of the crew members accidentally turned off the autopilot, possibly brushing against it, and the L-1011 descended. It started to descend, and there was no up or down. Nobody knew it was descending. There was just black and death. They slammed into the swamp at midnight, about 20 miles out from Miami. The plane broke apart. One wing was ripped off. It was a terrible crash. There were about 175 people on the L-1011. There were families on vacation. There were little children. 74 lived.
So 101 people died in that
crash? Right. 101 people died. And to that point in time, that was the worst air crash in the Everglades. Mm-hmm. There had been some smaller planes, but nothing like that.
Well, and then the Everglades is similar in terms of the Bermuda Triangle, right? Because it's so dark and creepy and, you know, things can get lost there.
Right. I called it the Bermuda Triangle for airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
Although in the Bermuda Triangle, they have been airplanes lost, too. There was the missing squadron mm-hmm. that flew out of Boca Raton, Florida during World War II and never was found.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the Everglades are a very tough place because there's nothing for a frame of reference visually.
Yes.
At any rate, my client, Tom McDermott, survived the explosion and the black cold waters. It was late December 1972. Excuse me?
It's incredible that he survived.
Oh, yeah. Well, 74 did. But they were chopped up, beat up. One, I think, died in the hospital. It was tough. He was strapped in and he found himself sinking, dazed and bloody. He was thrown out of the plane. His seat was projected out of the plane and he was bleeding from his skull. He was bleeding from a slice on his right leg. And half his clothes were torn off. With extreme effort, he fought to stay conscious. He released his seatbelt, and he started to swim away from the wreckage. The helicopter started to come in after what seemed to be a very, very long time, and he was fighting to stay awake.
Mm-hmm.
The blood was in his eyes. The water was black and cold, and his legs were numb. The screaming and the shouting were eerie. It was dark. There were no lights, no flashlights. It was living hell. And then he thought he heard somebody singing Christmas carols. Finally, they found him. He was dazed. He was shaking. He was mumbling incoherently. They picked him up in an airboat, and he was helicoptered to Jackson Memorial Hospital. That's the big hospital in Miami. Mm-hmm. The airboat guys had been out digging frogs. You know, that's hunting for frogs with a long pole with a hook at the end of it. And they would hook the frogs. They kept bringing in the survivors, even though they had some injuries, too. They were scraped up and beaten up. The doctors never told Tom how many stitches they put in his scalp and his leg. Try over 50 in the skull and 100 in the leg.
Oh, he was poor guy.
He was really messed up.
Yeah.
The recovery was very slow. And during this time, Tom contacted me about representing him. The first problem was that he was an employee of Eastern Airlines flying on a pass. Mm. So they tried to limit him to workers' compensation benefits, since Eastern claimed that he was in the course of his employment.
I see. Sneaky. Can you explain this a little bit? Yeah.
If you're in the course of your employment as part of your work duties, you can't sue the employer for liability for their negligence. Mm. You can only sue third parties, but not the employer. The employee's immune. It can only be responsible for workers' compensation benefits.
I see.
And workers' compensation benefits included medical care, but mm-hmm. he had that under a medical policy anyhow.
Right.
He was in a bad spot when he came to me. And also, in the meantime, his wounds became infected from the exposure to the swamp water, and he got infections in his leg and in his head. And it was gaseous gangrene from the swamp water.
It's terrible.
Tom wound up in a hyperbaric chamber being treated with pure oxygen. You know what a hyperbaric chamber is?
Mm-hmm. Huge tanks?
Well, sometimes you put your whole body in, but uh-huh. now they've got them small ones where you can just put your leg or your arm in, and then they just seal it. And mm-hmm. Well, he had to put his head in, and they sealed it, and he could only say that it was like being trapped in a coffin.
Oh my gosh. There was
a feeling of suffocation. The sides of the chamber kept crushing in, and one couldn't get out, and the scars would be forever, both inside and out, both mm-hmm. physical and mental. I filed a motion to dismiss the workers' compensation claim, and I had to do a very convincing argument to allow Tom to keep his liability claim alive against Eastern Airlines. But I decided not to file a lawsuit and to await the National Transportation Safety Board, it's called the NTSB, their investigation report. Others had filed in federal court, and the judge there had determined that those who filed were in a class action, and he appointed a committee of attorneys to investigate the cause of the crash, including John Appleton from New York City and Irwin Polite. That's not his real name. Mm-hmm. Everybody will know his real name in Miami. Yeah. Irwin Polite from Miami. Irwin was a well-known air crash specialist and a perfect gentleman. He's a lovely guy. But we didn't join in the McDermott claim with them. We never filed a lawsuit. We never used their investigation for advancing our claim. I didn't even look at their investigation. I was waiting for the National Transportation Safety Board investigation. Hmm. Well, the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, issued its report, and they found pilot error. The captain, Bob Loft, with 32 years of experience and almost 30,000 air hours, had, after placing the L-1011 on automatic pilot, accidentally leaned against the yoke. You know what the yoke is? That's the stick with the wheel on it, and it goes back and forth that steers the airplane.
Oh, God.
That brings it up and down.
How careless.
And when you lean on the yoke, you automatically release the automatic pilot. What happens is when a pilot lets go of the yoke, the automatic pilot immediately takes over and maintains the same course as when the pilot released it. Mm-hmm. If the yoke is then touched again, it goes back on manual, turning off the automatic pilot. So the plane had no control, and it started down. The yoke was loose, and he didn't know it, and he wasn't holding it.
Right. What a disaster.
And down it went. In addition, there was a failure of the crew to notice that the instruments, including the speaker altitude alert, were flashing. The TriStar Whisper Liner, almost brand new, started its descent unnoticed by the crew.
Ugh.
Wow, that was something.
How tragic.
One day the phone rang. I had filed a claim with Easton's attorneys, and it was Dick Thurman. And that's another altered name. He was a very nice guy. He was the senior partner of a large downtown defense firm. I guess in those days, we attorneys were kinder and trusted one another. It was another example of taking the high road. Mm-hmm. Like Mrs. Obama said, we take the high road. Uh-huh. Well, in those days, a lot of lawyers who considered themselves refined, gentle people, ladies and gentlemen, took the high road when we dealt with one another. Our handshake was good. Our word on the phone was good. You didn't need to have something in writing. Mm-hmm. It was done in a professional way.
It was a different era. I'm sure it doesn't work like that anymore.
No, it doesn't. It was always bad. Mm-hmm. You had to know who you were trusting.
Yes.
And anyhow, he called me and said, Lewis, this is Dick Thurman, and I'm instructed to settle the McDermott case. Just tell me what you want, and I'll try to get it. We've accepted liability. And you don't hear that today. Hmm. And I gave him a number.
That's a big deal.
And they accepted our offer. And McDermott was in the chips. What he did with his money is surprising. And I'll tell you about what happens with these settlements and some of the settlements from the L-10-11 crash. They all disappeared. The money was frivolously spent. Hmm. And anyway, I was glad to get a rather significant fee. My fee was $250,000.
Nice.
And,
Very good.
It was 33 1/3% of the total recovery. However, the next thing I knew, the federal court serves me with a federal order, determining without a hearing that my fee was subject to the court taking a significant portion of it and awarding it to the judge's committee.
What?
Namely 25%, which came to $62,000.
What?
Yeah. I filed a motion for relief, and I appeared specially. That means I wasn't submitting myself to the jurisdiction of the court. I was just coming in for special argument. And I said that I was not subject to the court's jurisdiction. I was not subjecting myself to it now. Mm-hmm. I had never filed a lawsuit. We weren't part of the class that was suing and before the court. We were not even in the court. We had no duty or obligation to anyone to share our fees for our independent settlement of this case. We were being deprived of our rights to our property unconstitutionally and without due process. The judge leaned over and said, "You received the benefit of the committee's work." "Judge, Your Honor, I respectfully don't think so. I relied on the NTSB investigation, and it wasn't until after Eastern Airlines received the report of the NTSB that they settled with us, and they settled out of court." The judge says, "Pay the committee 25% of your fee. It is so ordered."
Oh, goodness. How is that even possible? That doesn't make any sense.
I'm going to tell you about a lot of things in the law that don't make sense, that I think are wrong, and that get buried along the way. That's one of them.
So what did you do? What did
you appeal to this? I took an appeal to the 5th District Federal Court of Appeals in New Orleans. In the meantime, I placed my entire fee in a special trust account, an interest-bearing account, since the appellate court might even award more than the federal district judge. And sometimes that happens. An injustice occurs in a lower court, and you take an appeal, and the appellate court says, "You didn't get tattooed enough. We're going to tattoo you more." And they make it worse. And it's a way of saying, "We're punishing you for taking our time to take an appeal, to look at this thing. You should know better. And now we're going to make you suffer."
Oh, man.
And
wow.
They have this attitude.
Yeah.
And judges do not consider themselves as lawyers, even though almost all of them are.
Yeah.
They are judges, and that's a separate world, and they don't appreciate receiving $150,000 or $200,000 a year in salary, and the lawyer is making $200,000 in that one case.
There's resentment there, definitely.
A lot of resentment. Anyhow, my brief was fairly emotional. I said the United States Constitution prohibits the taking of property without due process. The court had no jurisdiction over me. The committee's work was unknown to me and never used by me. Mm-hmm. Easton settled based on the government investigation, which found Easton responsible.
Exactly.
And I found out that I wasn't the only one taking an appeal. Mine was joined by about 6 other attorneys who were similarly having portions of their fee awarded to the committee. And I was sorry I wasn't on the committee because they were in line to collect the bundle. And it was nice that Irwin Polite was friendly with the federal judge. Uh-huh. They were friends, and Irwin was down there all the time on airplane cases. And so it was nice to be on the committee. Mm-hmm. At any rate, it was a cold and dreary day in New Orleans when the appeal was being heard. It was teeming. It was pouring. Umbrellas were inadequate. And there I was in this huge marble federal appeals courthouse, walking down the corridor. It was like a Greek temple. And I felt very small. And as I walked down the hallway, dripping from the rain, shaking my umbrella and looking for the courtroom, when a gentleman approached me, he said, "Are you Lewis Ress? I'm John Appleton. Do you want to settle the case?" Huh? And that's how cases are settled, out on the side, walking around.
Right.
Very often the lawyers get together and talk. Not so much nowadays. So I said, "Mr. Appleton, I'm honored to meet you. And I know whatever my claims of injustice are, they weren't instigated by you. You enjoy a fine reputation." It's not stupid to get him off the hook and be nice to him.
Yeah.
He was just trying to do what the court had ordered.
Exactly.
So I had deposited my entire fee in this bank account, as I told you, interest bearing. And it was, in those days, it was very high interest. I think the 18% was the standard interest in those days.
Oh, wow. So now you get maybe 0.6.
Right. It did change. It was Jimmy Carter's days, the Carter administration. So the interest alone was over $15,000. So he says, Lewis, you have the strongest case of the group, and I would glad to let you go home. How about $12,000? I said, done, done. It was a done deal.
Great.
Well, the appellate court ruled because the other six didn't settle. They didn't offer them a settlement. Mm-hmm. And the appellate court found that it was quite okay for the district judge to appoint a committee and award whatever fees he deemed appropriate and to take a portion of those fees from the attorneys who were not before the court since they benefited from the committee's efforts. If I had not settled, I would have tried to get the attention of the United States Supreme Court. But I don't think they're thrilled at the thought of protecting attorney's fees.
Right. Yeah, it would have been probably a waste of your time.
They would have been annoyed, and they probably would never have taken jurisdiction.
Yeah.
At any rate, the aftermath.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, Tom McDermott was a 6'4" Irish-American with a great sense of humor and a kind and pleasant attitude, about 15 years younger than I. He originally worked at Eastern Airlines, and gradually after the accident, he became a baggage balancer, you know, load balancer. He no longer could work behind the counter or lift baggage.
Oh.
But he was really a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
When he first retained me, when he first, you know, signed a retainer agreement with me, he said, okay, Res, you'll represent me, you'll get your fee, and you'll be gone. You'll never bother with me again. He was just a very tough guy. I said, I don't know what came over me, but I answered, that won't be so, Tom. We'll become friends, and I'll be your friend for life. It was a foolish thing to say, one of those statements that seems hollow and meaningless, a promise to someone I hardly knew. We had very little in common, but there was something genuine about Tom, and it came through, and it could be sensed just by being around him, watching him, listening to him. He was a straight talker. I enjoyed him, and he was truly celebrating his life, every minute of it.
Of course, especially after that near-death experience he had.
Even before, he was a happy guy.
That's great.
Tom loved to fish, and he took his money and he bought three fishing boats. One of them, a party fishing boat, over 60 feet long, and the whole thing was called the Royal Fleet. That's not the real name. They were, I don't want to offend people. They were docked down at Howard Johnson's Motel down in Key Largo. That's true. For a while, Tom did quite well, and he kept his job at Eastern Airlines, and he became a weight balancer, as I told you, checking the freight and the distribution in the cargo hold. He kept sending me injured Eastern Airlines employees, his clients, and I did quite well for them and for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Colonel Frank Borman became the CEO of Eastern Airlines, and he was a no-nonsense military type. You know, he was the astronaut. He was a test pilot.
Yeah, impressive.
And then after being a test pilot, he was an aeronautical engineer. And then he was the famous astronaut. He was the commander of Gemini 7 and, of course, of Apollo 8. And I don't know if you remember, Apollo 8 rode to the dark side of the moon.
Hmm.
He also, unknown to many, had a Harvard Business Law degree. And he, when they heard about the crash, he raced from his home to the scene of the crash, and he helped rescue the injured. He was a very fine guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he ran a tight ship at Eastern, and he worked with the new CEO, Frank Lorenzo, to keep the company profitable and to control the unions.
Hmm.
They were having economic problems. Frank Lorenzo was clearly anti-union, and he fired a number of mechanics, possibly with the idea of ultimately having a non-union company. Finally, the head of the mechanics union, who was also an egotist and had a power complex, instigated a strike against Easton. Mr. Lorenzo, the CEO, would suffer no insurrection. They went head-to-head, these strong-willed men. Both lost. Eastern Airlines went bankrupt and never came out of it.
Well, there you go.
No mergers, no compromises, no reorganizations. All the Eastern employees lost their jobs.
That's terrible.
The mechanics would probably get other employment. But everyone lost their retirement and their seniority. And it's said that Mr. Lorenzo walked away with $750 million.
Oh, how convenient.
And the end result was that a major airline based in Miami was lost in great part due to conflicting egos.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you about that in our discussion. Fortunately, Tom retired at the right time. As part of his retirement, Tom would take one of his boats to the Bahamas. And I once met him in Bimini. And I brought my younger son, Brad, who was 16 years old. They hit it off, and they fished, and they did some serious beer drinking together. 16 years in the Bahamas, you can drink.
Nice.
And my wife liked Tom. And when he remarried, she took a liking to his new wife. So we saw them fairly regularly. And as part of his dream retirement, Tom moved to Key Largo. And we used to go down to visit with him and to fish with him. His fishing rod was called the Irish Stick.
Beautiful down there. I'm sure he was loving it.
He did. It was a great life. And you know as well as I do that economics isn't a science and that the road for money is bumpy.
Yep, and it's not cheap to live in Key Largo.
No, it isn't. And the economy drops and people stop paying to fish. And it happened sort of gradually. I'm not sure how long it took. But things went downhill in the sport fishing industry, and Tom lost his boats, even his own personal 35-footer, on which he and his recent wife are living.
Oh.
The next thing I learned was that Tom wasn't doing so well. He was working as a bartender at the Howard Johnsons.
Hmm.
Colonel Frank Borman retired, and he moved back to Arizona and then to New Mexico. I think he suffers from a sinus problem. He was born in 1928, and he is still active. Captain Bob Loft, who died in the accident, he was found to have a brain tumor at the time of the crash, but it was never determined that it contributed to the accident.
Oh, wow.
He and flight engineer Don Rippo, who also died in the crash, have been cited after the crash a number of times by a number of different former Eastern employees on other 1011s.
Huh.
And their ghosts, it's a whole story. Their ghosts were thought to haunt that series of aircraft.
Spooky.
There have been no reported sightings since the L-1011s went out of service and disappeared. Colonel Borman says the whole thing is nonsense, which of course it is. Tom was having his own ghost problems. He was seeing little men. They were coming into his bedroom at night to visit him.
Oh no.
Maybe they come from the swamps. His legs gradually stopped working, possibly from the damage caused by the crash. He was placed in a rest home in Naples, and finally was able to get into a nicer rehabilitation facility in Isla Mirada. So he's back in the Keys. He's run out of money. He's still cheery and full of life. My wife and I keep my promise. We visit. We make sure that he has money in his account and plenty of beer in his cooler.
Oh, that's so you still see him?
Well, it's over now. It's over.
Oh, he passed away?
Tom died just a few months ago.
Oh, no.
His heart must have given out. He was ill and they didn't know what it was. It was just a general malaise. The funeral party took two boats out into the Atlantic. Tom's ashes were put in a light brown biodegradable fiber container in the shape of a turtle. And he was lowered onto the reef off Key Largo.
That's beautiful. That's a wonderful send-off.
Yeah, there was a lot of drinking.
Yeah.
So that's
I'm sure he would have been happy with that, that send-off.
Yes, he would. So I can tell you more if you want to hear.
Oh, yeah.
About Eastern Airlines. Eastern Airlines was actually formed by Eddie Rickenbacker. You don't know who Eddie Rickenbacker is?
Nope.
Well, these are the famous pilots from World War One. You know?
Oh.
The aces from World War
One. Yeah.
And Frank Borman was, of course, a famous pilot. The destruction of the airline, they never came out of bankruptcy. Most airlines go into bankruptcy and they adjust the union contracts. The unions, the pilots' unions, the flight attendants' unions would have very tough contracts, but which were strangling the airlines. They couldn't make a living. They couldn't pay anything to the shareholders. The stock would go down.
Uh-huh.
So they were always trying to renegotiate these contracts that, to avoid strikes.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're in bankruptcy, the bankruptcy judge would call everybody in and reorganize the company and modify the union contracts so that the company could become economically viable. But in this instance, the two leaders clashed. Frank Lorenzo was a very, very tough, egotistical man. I think he lives in Houston now. He's around 70 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in a company called Savoy Capital, which owns Chinese restaurants, I
think.
Yes,
I've heard of it, yeah.
Charlie Brown was the name of the guy from the union. When you do mediation, sometimes you want to get people to settle.
Mm-hmm.
And you show them a picture of two guys out in the middle of a river swimming. And each of them has their hands around the other guy's neck. And they both drown.
Yes. Yes, it's a beautiful metaphor.
It doesn't help.
Yeah.
They all drown.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was everyone suffers.
Yeah.
First of all, the pilots and the flight attendants. And all the clerical workers and the mechanics. You have all the people that service them, the airport people, and all of the related businesses at the airport. Eastern was the biggest airline in Miami at the time. Then you have the secondary people, like travel agents, people that sell travel insurance, things like that. Then you have the taxis and everybody that is related to the industry. There's a ripple effect.
Yeah.
And the whole community shuddered when that happened. Miami was not that big or strong economically, and it really had an enormous effect on the community. Finally, American Airlines came in and replaced it in many ways. Mm-hmm. But the mechanics could get other jobs. They were very employable. Mm-hmm. But the pilots and the flight attendants, even if they got other jobs with other airlines, which they couldn't get, they all lost their retirement and their seniority. So if you were working in the airlines for 5-10 years,
That's it.
You had retirement seniority, it's all gone.
Yeah.
That was terrible. It was terrible.
And this also happened to companies like Pan Am and others. Pretty much the same story, similar story.
Right, right. Pan Am, of course, was the flying boats. And mm-hmm. they started off at a Dinakee Marina. Did you know that?
No.
They started their one trip was the president and the founder. And they had these flying boats, and they would fly to Cuba from Miami.
Very,
it was very fashionable,
very cool.
And you would wear a coat and tie when you got a. And they would serve food and everything. It was very luxurious. They tried to replace trains, and what
did
happened
you ever
then,
fly on Pan Am? Huh? Did you ever fly on Pan Am?
Oh yeah, but yeah. I flew later on when they were and landing in airports.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, yeah. But you never did the boat thing.
No, not that old. That's really goes back a long time.
Okay.
I think that ended in the 30s. What happened is they couldn't get the route over to Europe. This mm-hmm. fellow, Juan Tripp, was very aggressive, and he wanted to see how far these flying boats
could go. Yeah.
They were actually a wing with four motors on it and one gas tanks. And he wanted to see, and then the gondola hung from below where the passengers were.
My.
And that's what touched the water when you landed. So they tried to get it to where it would have enough gasoline fuel to fly over to Europe. Mm-hmm. With the passengers. Mm-hmm. And they would have to fly from Gander, you know, to Newfoundland.
Uh-huh.
To go, they still use that way across. Mm-hmm. And so England, they'd have to go to England because the range would not let them fly otherwise. And England wouldn't give them landing rights.
No.
They were having an argument of some kind. They didn't have a plane that could do it.
Uh-huh.
So they were jealous.
Right.
So then Juan Tripp says, well, okay, I'll fly in the South Pacific. And that's how those planes went to the South Pacific, to Hawaii and everything from Los Angeles. That was an enormous flight.
Mm-hmm.
And the islands in the Pacific are like little dots. Mm-hmm. So they had to create a whole system of radio communications, radio beacons to zone in on. And that was all. They had to build them on these islands.
Wow.
And there was a very interesting question. It helped create the radar later on mm-hmm. and how the air industry progressed. So,
very interesting.
Airline industry is very tough. There have been, I can tell you, 20 airlines have disappeared mm-hmm. in the last few years. You name Pan American and Eastern, you know. So what about National Airlines? You ever hear of them? That was a big airline in Miami, National. And Frontier.
Frontier, yeah.
And Braniff.
Mm-hmm.
And Avianca from Chile, I think it was. And Florida Air, Continental, TWA, just a few of them.
I didn't know it was a Florida Air.
Oh, yeah, there was a great Florida Air. It served Florida mostly, and it went under. So that's the beginning of the story I was going to tell you. I was going to tell you about the worst crash
mm-hmm.
where 110 people died. And that was the DC-9 value jet crash. Do you know anything about that?
No.
Well, the L-1011 crash was 1972, December 29th. And the DC-9 crash was not until 1996. It was 24 years later,
mm-hmm.
May 11th. And what happened was, you know what a DC-9 is, you know, with the twin motors on the side of the plane.
Oh, okay.
And
yeah.
They were at the gate. They were on the way to Atlanta from Miami. And they both happened at night, by the way. As I recall, the L-1011 crash was around midnight.
Hmm.
And this one was at 11:42, around the same time over the airplane.
Don't fly at night.
And what happened was they packed canisters of oxygen as cargo.
Uh-oh.
In the hold, and they didn't tell anybody.
What?
And the canisters were supposed to be empty, but they weren't.
Oh, my goodness.
And they had like a valve at the end, a nipple at the end, and the canisters bumped against one another.
Oh,
and one of the covers, the
that could have been avoided.
Off, and it shot out. It was under high pressure.
Of course.
And then there was the pressure going up in the airplane, and it heated up from the pressure. And it exploded into flames, and it was in the cargo bin right below where the pilot was.
Oh, my gosh.
And the flames came up through the floorboards. They were about 10 minutes out of Miami. They had been held up at the gate for mechanical problems for about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were released, and they flew. And then this thing happened as they took off, and 10 minutes later, it was on fire.
Plane, can you please tell me how that happened? Like, how did no one regulate the fact that they put oxygen?
It was a big lawsuit. It was a big lawsuit. You remember, Value Jet was a tiny little airline. It was not like Eastern Airlines. So they were about 10 minutes out. This happened. The Value Jet crash was within 2 miles of the L-1011 crash.
Wow.
L-1011 was coming in. Value Jet was going out.
Mm-hmm.
Value Jet turned and climbed and banked and then headed straight down 90 degrees perpendicular, like a guy diving off a diving board, straight into the Everglades, straight down, and entered the Everglades.
There weren't any survivors in that one, right?
They couldn't find a piece of debris from the plane.
I'm sure there were.
The plane got sucked in. I've seen the site.
Oh,
it's
God.
A swamp.
Devastating.
And all there was a slick of oil there and a couple of pieces of debris, tiny little pieces. The plane has never been found. Everyone died.
Of course.
110 people disappeared. They didn't die. They disappeared.
Yeah.
Because they were never exhumed. The bodies were never obtained, taken out.
Well, in the explosion, everything went.
There was no explosion. It just went down.
Oh, straight. Went straight down.
Straight down and into the ground. And it was sucked in like into the black hole. And it disappeared. And no one has seen anything of it. All there was a slick of oil and nothing else. Today, there's a memorial. So if you go 10 miles west of Chrome Avenue in Miami, you'll see they put up these monuments on a piece of land. And the land is like an arrowhead pointing 10 miles
to where it
this
dropped.
Is not where the, this is not,
yeah,
you can
yeah,
go there and
course.
Pray.
It's
the plane went in 10 miles from there. You can't get out there. It's impossible to reach.
So
you can't
sad.
Build a road out there from what I gather. So it's a horror.
Mm-hmm.
It was a horror. And, of course, there was a lot of litigation. A Value Jet bought another company and absorbed a small company and changed its name to the company's name, which is AirTran. And then AirTran was acquired by Southwest Airlines.
Mm. Okay.
So, if you fly Southwest Airlines, it's the parent or the owner of the former Value Jet. So does that tell you a little bit?
Yeah.
I was going to tell you about the lousy court decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, please do.
And then I'll end it. There's a thing, it's called certiorari, C-E-R-T-I-O-R-A-R-I, certiorari. And what it is the court decides whether to take jurisdiction or not. Certiorari denied means they do not change the ruling. Certiorari granted means they'll hear oral argument. Now they'll say certiorari denied with no opinion.
That
means
that?
With all the appellate things, you wrote the brief and you filed the appeal, and the appellate court says, sorry, we're not going to give you an opinion. And we're not going to explain our reasoning, and that's it. And there's nothing to appeal from that. That's the Intermediate
that's
Court
it.
Of Appeal. So you can't go up because there's nothing to appeal.
Right.
It's a dirty trick. And there's been a lot of complaints from the bar that should be done away with. And you should be able to get a ruling that you can appeal if you don't like it.
Yeah, of course. You should have a choice, at least.
Then, you know, the Supreme Court has made a lot of stupid decisions. And, well, I shouldn't say stupid, but highly questionable decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, the court, in its brilliance, Justice Kavanaugh, the new justice, decided that the governor of, I think it's Wisconsin, who is a Republican, can refuse to count absentee ballots, even though they were posted in the mail before Election Day, if they are not received by Election Day. So if you vote the day before or 2 days before the election, and the postman, which is already under the control of the government and told to slow down the mails, they deliver it on Wednesday in the election zone. After Tuesday night at 7 o'clock or something, they're not going to count them. And the Supreme Court said that's okay.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and then
other people can do. Then that could be, you know, presence for other cases. And
right. And then there's another rule. Then there's another incredible ruling that I should tell you about. In the Gore v. Bush, when the court ruled that they would deny a recount of the Florida vote, which was the control of the election, and they automatically determined that Bush would be the president. And Sandra Day O'Connor was the one that she was the swing vote that was responsible. And she admitted in a speech that she did that because she's a Republican and she thought that Bush would be better for the country.
Oh my goodness.
Now, that's a political.
They're not supposed to affiliate.
It's a horrible thing. And nobody talks about it. The justices or the associate justices on the Supreme Court.
Of course they have a side.
They can't open their mouths.
Of course there's going to be, you know, people, it's very hard for people to be impartial.
Right.
You know, maybe within a courtroom, but
well,
in their personal lives, they're going to choose a side. And that's going to affect their decisions somehow.
We all are affected to some degree by our beliefs.
Of course.
And whether we think we're not, we think we're objective, but nobody can be objective.
Yeah.
We're all in great part the result of our beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you another case that nobody knows about if you want to know.
Yeah.
You won't like it because Justice Ginsburg was a good acquaintance of mine.
Oh.
I grew up knowing her family and everything. But she made a ruling once.
That was not good.
Her rulings in the appellate court were very pro-corporation.
Oh.
But she had a ruling in a criminal case.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you the story. The husband was caught with drugs in the car.
Mm-hmm.
But it was his wife's car. And they impounded the car and wouldn't give it back and wouldn't pay for it and said that it was being used to commit a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And the lawsuit was the United States versus the 1927 Cadillac or whatever, 1949. That's the Cadillac was made a party defendant.
Oh,
and,
my goodness.
The wife came in and said, hey, wait a minute. That's my car. And my husband took it without my permission.
Mm-hmm.
And I want my car back. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg says, the car is a party to the lawsuit. And the car was used in a crime. And you cannot have your car back.
Wow.
Car is treated as a person.
Oh, no.
And then you get the Supreme Court treating corporations as people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really ludicrous. So
yeah.
A lot of that stuff is political, economics.
Do you think that ruling had something to do with how we handle corporations? Because she said that sort of...
Well, the reason that I can attribute to her doing that is that when you have law enforcement, and you have airplanes and boats that are used for drugs, you want to be able to pick them up and not give them back to the owner's always going to say it was stolen.
Uh-huh.
The owner's always going to say they were without my permission. Then the government has to come in and show that it was with their permission, and that's
mm-hmm.
a tough burden.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to grab that stuff. So as a practical matter, that ruling helps the DEA.
Mm. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. So that's today's
discussion. Good information on crashes and airlines and bad rulings. It's a good blend of information. Thank you.
And get my new book.
Yes. Go out and get it. It's very good.
Right. It's called Miami Memoirs.
You can get
Memoirs,
it on Amazon.
Miami Memoirs, including the story of the Maharani's ring.
Perfect. All right. Go get that book, everyone.